Vaccine Agenda Internet Radio Show. I'm your host, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, coming to you live from the Vaccine Rights Studios in beautiful Asheville, North Carolina. On this Monday, July 20th, August 2015, this time space was formerly a show for the Know Your Rights Hour with Dr. Mayor Eisenstein and myself as co-hosts, but now this is the Vaccine Agenda Internet Radio Show. We are still sponsored by the Natural Farm Source in tribute to the late Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Go to homefirst.com and click on the store button for vitamin A, vitamin C, probiotics, and other natural supplements to help you stay healthy naturally. Archives of the show are available at blogtalkradio.com/thevaccineagenda and at naturalnewsradio.com. Theme music was written and produced by yours truly. You can subscribe to the free Vaccine Rights e-newsletter at vaccinerights.com. Each weekly issue has news about upcoming vaccine radio shows, links to current vaccine news and legal articles, and you can help defray the costs of bringing you the Vaccine Agenda Radio Show, purchasing the authoritative guide to vaccine legal exemptions, also available at vaccinerights.com. Please tell others about the show, and it is available live and in archives. We have a lot of people who don't listen to the show live but do get to it in the archives. Well, enough for announcements. Let's move on to this evening's show. I am excited to have with us this evening Neil Miller. Neil Miller is a researcher and author on the vaccine issue for decades now, probably 25 or 30 years, give or take. I'll let him clarify that point, but he has a special place in my heart because his first book was the first book that I read when my oldest child was born over 20 years ago, 21 years ago now. Vaccines, are they really safe and effective? And Neil has revised that book from time to time. It's still a great book, but he's got a new one coming out. We're going to ask him about that. Neil, let me see. I'm going to have to turn your microphone on or you're not going to be able to respond to me here. Neil Miller, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Alan. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's a pleasure and honor on this end and for all of us listening. Neil, boy, we could go in 1,000 different directions, and you're knowledgeable on 999 of them, if not all 1,000. But you mentioned right before the show you have a new book coming out, and I would love for you to tell us a little bit about that. But before we dive into that, because I want to make sure I don't forget this, you are the second in a series of guests through the summer, all of whom are scheduled presenters at a conference in October in Dallas, Texas, HP Worldwide Choice. So I just wanted to plug the conference very briefly, ask you, Neil, if you could tell us a little bit about what you're going to be presenting about there without, of course, giving away too much. We want people to come see you there. But HP, short for homeoprophylaxis, this is an aspect of the vaccine controversy that I feel is potentially a huge one, and yet has gotten very, very little coverage, perhaps in part because homeopathy has been so criticized and suppressed by mainstream medicine, but so has anything else that's not part of the pharmaceutical agenda. And it's time, I think, to the extent that homeopathy has been in the closet, and homeoprophylaxis in particular with respect to the vaccine issue, I think it's time to bring it out. And this conference, I hope, will be, and think it will be, a big step in that direction. So just real briefly for listeners, homeoprophylaxis, this is sort of a generalization here. Homeoprophylaxis refers to particular types of homeopathic remedies that are used more or less in the same kind of function as allopathic immunization. And the big point for me about homeoprophylaxis is that a lot of people will frame the vaccine issue in a way that I think is misframing it. They'll say, well, which is worse, the vaccines or the diseases? And, you know, we can debate that topic forever. But homeoprophylaxis is sort of a, and that concept in a broader sense is a third direction. It's not just a question of which is worse or safer or better, the vaccines or the diseases, but rather there are other options there. There are things we can do nutritionally and otherwise to take care of ourselves, strengthen our bodies so we're resistant to disease or recover quickly. But then homeoprophylaxis is a whole other arena all unto itself. And homeopathic remedies that are the homeoprophylaxis remedies have demonstrated great success over the last couple of hundred years or so that homeopathy has been around and used in countries around the world, effectively to prevent disease. So are there other options? So I think this conference in Dallas in October is going to be a great conference. It's got, why am I drawing a blank here?
Well, there's going to be a lot of great people at this conference that are speaking out. So I just want to make it clear, I'm not speaking out on homeopathy. That's not my topic. I think there's three of us as speakers that have been invited to this homeopathic conference. Dr. Wakefield is one person that's been invited. He will be speaking about the whistleblower status, I believe, a little bit about vaccines and the whistleblower status. I'll be speaking about the vaccine studies, the latest research on vaccine studies. But the conference is billed as a homeopathic conference, and there are many experts that are coming, in fact, from around the world on that topic. So there's going to be a mix of experts on homeopathy, and there's going to be three speakers, myself included as one of them, speaking about vaccines.
And I think it's really terrific because it's like they've gotten just a small number of us to sort of, in a sense, is a setup for the need and how important it is to then take a look at the homeopathic picture and the homeoprophylaxis as an alternative to vaccination. So, yes, they've got you, Dr. Wakefield, talking about some of the corruption, you talking about some of the science, me coming in talking about some of the legal aspects pertaining to vaccines. And I think most, if not all, of the rest of the other presenters then will be speaking more directly focused on...
Actually, now that you mention it, I actually forgot about you. You're speaking about the legal aspects of vaccination. There's another woman, say her name.
Yes, Tatiana Obukanich, Dr. Obukanich.
Yes, Tatiana is going to be speaking about vaccines as well, and she is excellent. So there's actually four of us that are speaking on vaccines. And by the way, if anybody wants to learn more about this conference, it is in October, October 2nd to the 4th, it's in Dallas, Texas, and I know up on my website at thinktwice.com, I posted a little banner. If you click on that banner, it will take you directly to the website so that people can get more information and register if they want to.
Yeah, and thank you for reminding me. I'd forgotten briefly that Tatiana is going to be there as well. And all four of us who are not talking about homeopathy are taking on different facets or aspects of the vaccine issue. So it really is going to be comprehensive in that sense, but in a very concise way, if you will. You know, you could spend, you know, you could bring in dozens of people talking for days to fully cover the vaccine issue, but we're going to hit some critical parts of it, and then these other folks are just going to take off and talk about the homeopathic solution here or alternative. So it's going to be a really terrific conference. I am really excited to be there to meet all these people. I don't think you and I have ever met in person, Neil. I'm looking forward to that.
We did time. Actually once, Alan. I think you came and listened to one of my talks when I presented at an Autism One Generation Rescue conference, I believe it was.
Yep.
In 2010 in Chicago. In fact, you came up and greeted me and introduced yourself, I remember. And I was happy to finally meet you after all these years.
Terrific. Thank you. I'm so glad your memory is working better than mine this evening. So it'll be great to see you again. I've met Dr. Wakefield before, but only briefly. I'll be delighted to see him again. And Tatiana, I don't think we've talked several times. I don't think I've ever met her in person. And then these people from Europe and Australia, who some of them I'm familiar with and some not, but these are all some... top people, and from here in the U.S.
This is going to be a great conference, and I hope a lot of people decide to come and listen to all the wisdom that's going to be, wisdom and knowledge that's going to be shared from all of these great speakers.
Well, you've got a new book coming out then, probably maybe a little before or around the time of the conference?
Well, I was hoping to have the book out by the time of this conference, but I'm kind of very particular, and I keep trying to wrap the book up, and these new studies keep getting published, and I keep summarizing these new studies and including them in my book. It keeps pushing the timetable back, but we're getting pretty close. The index for the book is actually being worked on as we speak. So this book, the cover has been designed, and the book is pretty much complete, and we're looking to have this book out by the end of the year. So, and this book is going to be a review of over 400 studies that are critical of vaccines. These are peer-reviewed studies published in medical journals, and these are all studies that have found some kind of a problem with vaccines. Either the vaccine has some kind of a risk or increases the odds of developing a neurological or immunological injury. Two new studies, actually one new study that just came out a couple of weeks ago, is very, very important, and I'm very happy that I didn't get the book published yet until this study made it into the book. This new study is by some Japanese researchers, and what they discovered is that when you contract measles or mumps in childhood, it actually protects you against deadly heart attacks and strokes when you become an adult. And the data, they looked at over 100,000 men and women. So it's a very large study, a very large population that was looked at over several years. And they discovered that people that caught these childhood diseases, measles and mumps, were significantly protected against dying as an adult from heart attacks or strokes. People that did not contract these diseases were significantly more likely to have heart attacks and strokes later in life. And I have several other studies in this book that's coming out later this year that shows very similar things, for example, with cancer, that these childhood diseases that you and I, everyone our age, let's say everyone in their 50s, for example, we all caught these childhood diseases. We caught measles and mumps and chicken pox. And in fact, doctors used to recommend that if we didn't catch these diseases, that we would go next door. The doctors would actually say, go next door, play with the kids, so that you catch these childhood diseases when you're a child. Because these diseases, and the doctors knew this back then, they were usually not problematic when you caught them as a child. They provided you with all sorts of benefits to your immunity later in life. And if you didn't catch the disease as a child, but caught it later as an adolescent or an adult, the disease was more likely to cause complications. But this study that I'm talking about not only provides evidence, very strong evidence, that these diseases, these childhood diseases, are very important for developing and stimulating our immune system against things like cardiovascular disease, but they also protect us against various cancers. I've got more than 20 different studies in this new book. And the book summarizes each of these studies. There's one study per page, and there's several bullet points that very simply summarize the main findings of the study. And I've got 20 studies published in peer-reviewed journals that confirm that when children contract these diseases, they are protected against various types of cancers in later life. Children that are vaccinated against these diseases are prevented from developing that natural protection, and they are then more likely to develop cancers in later life. So in effect, what we've done, what the medical industry and the pharmaceutical industry has done, they've in effect caused us to have a trade-off. We've traded a reduced incidence of these diseases. Of course, measles and mumps and chickenpox was endemic when we grew up. Endemic is just a fancy word that means it was widely circulating throughout society, and most everybody caught those diseases. after the vaccines were developed, fewer people caught these diseases, but the trade-off is that there were increased rates of cancer and increased rates of cardiovascular disease as well. So we're trading off, we're making a trade-off. Reduced incidence of disease for increased incidence of cancer and cardiovascular disease. And these are just two areas that I'm discussing right now. There's many, many studies. For example, I have a chapter just on aluminum adjuvants. The aluminum is being linked to neurological ailments. We can look at thimerosal. That's a separate chapter. We've got about 30 studies in that chapter, peer-reviewed studies, that link mercury in vaccines to various types of autistic behaviors, neurodevelopmental problems, things of that nature. So there are many, many different problems with the vaccines, and a lot of people don't realize that these problems have been documented, scientifically documented. And so what I've done with this new book is I've collected the documentation and put it all in one place so that you and I and new parents and researchers have a reference for all of these studies that are critical of vaccines. And I'll tell you now the name of the book. I call it Miller's Review of Critical Vaccine Studies, 400 Important Scientific Papers Summarized for Parents and Researchers. Hopefully, this book will also be given to legislators, the lawmakers that right now are being bought by the pharmaceutical company, and they're being lobbied very hard to pass laws that mandate vaccines so that children and the parents of school children no longer have options to exempt their children from these vaccines. This is a very dangerous precedent that's being set. California, as many people know, has just passed mandatory laws. All children going to school in the state of California, starting in January of next year, are now obligated to receive all the vaccines that the CDC recommends. This is a dangerous precedent. A lot of people don't realize that we're moving towards adult vaccines now, where the movement is to mandate vaccines for employment, so that if you want to be a teacher in a school, we're only probably a few years away from when they're going to be starting to push that teachers have to receive all the vaccines. If you're an adult working in hospitals, a nurse, any kind of medical field, already many of these nurses and other health practitioners, health workers, are being forced or compelled to take vaccines against their will if they want to keep their jobs. So we're moving into very dangerous territory at this point in our country, where we're more and more infringing on human rights. This is a form of medical enslavement. This is medical tyranny. And hopefully we can muster some kind of strategy, some kind of educational plan, so that we can educate the legislators and educate the parents and educate everyone else, including the medical doctors, so that they understand that there are problems with vaccines. These problems have been documented in peer-reviewed medical studies, and that the issue of whether or not to vaccinate has to remain a free choice.
Boy, Neil, you covered so many critical points there, and I really appreciate every last one of them. I kept every few moments having a question come up, and now I have a list of questions. I don't remember most of them, but one of the things that, of course, I'm a big fan, and we're on the same side of the issue here, but I think it's partly just my nature, but also my profession as well, to play devil's advocate. What do you say when somebody says something like, yeah, but those were all the bad studies? You know, surely you at some point have encountered somebody trying to just sort of sweepingly dismiss everything. Because surely there are, and please correct me or clarify on this next point, surely there are, with at least some of these points that you're covering in your book or have covered in the past in your other books and in articles and so forth. Surely there are times when there are conflicting studies, and there, when that happens, there reasonably arises a question, well, either who's right or what do you do about that? And just so to sort of clarify my own position, if we did nothing more than acknowledge that there are conflicting studies where that is true, where that's the case, that in and of itself, for me, would be all the reason we need for government not to be making the decision for us, but for us
exactly.
to have that decision, you know, with our own healthcare providers. But what is your response to just that sort of general, again, surely you've encountered that where somebody you've read
well,
or somebody has maybe said to you, well, those are the bad studies, you know, the preconceived conclusion.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I was very comprehensive in collecting the studies on various topics. For example, the aluminum chapter, I've got like 15 or 20, I can't even remember. Thimerosal, the chapter on mercury's got 30 studies. I've got a chapter on something that I call pertussis mutations. For example, a lot of people don't realize that the medical industry is telling everybody that unvaccinated people are the reason that whooping cough or pertussis is spreading, why there's an increase of cases, when this is absolutely untrue. I've got 25 studies that confirm, and all the scientists know that that's not the truth. It's not unvaccinated people that are causing the pertussis disease to spread. It's the vaccine itself, which has stimulated selective adaptation. It's a form of evolutionary adaptation where the vaccine itself has caused the pertussis microorganisms to evade the vaccine. And now the vaccine is no longer protective against the new bacterium, the new strains of the pertussis organism that are circulating in society. They've mutated. They've adapted. So the vaccine is no longer effective. The new strains, we've got parapertussis, and we've got different strains of the pertussis toxins that have evaded the vaccine itself, which are causing the circulating strains of whooping cough to actually be more virulent. So when you collect 20 different studies, that tells a story. It's not like one study against another study, okay? But to answer your question more directly, in my introduction, I actually speak to this. I speak to this issue that you bring up. What do you do when you have one study that says one thing, but you have another study that says another thing? And how does that happen? How can that happen? Okay, well, one of the reasons it happens, I actually cover in the very last chapter in my new book. The very last chapter in my new book is called Conflicts of Interest, False Studies, and Industry Control. There are 17 studies in that chapter that confirm that the pharmaceutical companies and the biomedical industry are actually manipulating data and falsifying studies. People don't realize this, but there are several studies on studies, not just meta-analyses where they analyze several studies on the same topic. But these are studies where they've gone in. For example, one study goes in and actually interviews scientists who work for the National Institutes of Health, okay? And these are anonymous surveys from top scientists that work for the United States. And they admit, very high percentages admit that they experience extreme pressure from pharmaceutical industry to alter the results of their studies so that they either take out things that are detrimental to the interests of the company that is providing the grant or put things in different ways. They frame things differently or they change a methodology or they use a different statistical technique to either come up with the results that they want or to wipe away results that they don't like. This is very, very common. There's another individual, his name is John Ioannidis, who has investigated extensively. He's very well respected in the world of statistics. And he goes around and gives lectures all around the world on how studies are biased. There's immense amount of bias in studies, not just from premeditated bias, which is very common in the biomedical field, where, for example, pharmaceutical companies oversee the studies of their own material, of their own products. This is a very serious problem. This is a problem where you've got a lot of corruption and you've got a lot of false studies that are claiming to show one thing or to not show another thing, and we just can't trust that, according to John Ioannidis. According to John Ioannidis, a majority of the actual studies that are out there, especially in the biomedical field, are false. They're just flat out false. So, coming back to the question, how does a parent or how does a researcher wade through all of this when you've got several studies that say that, for example, one vaccine is safe, and you've got several other studies that say that the same vaccine is actually very dangerous? And that's where everybody has to use their own discretion. They're going to have to be able to wade through this data, and I've made it easy with this new book. I've summarized these studies quite simply, and I recommend that people go to the original source and actually read the original studies to find out exactly what's going on in the biomedical field.
Yeah, and just to add a little another piece to that, Neil, I came across a piece of information that the editor-in-chief of The Lancet, Richard Horton, just this past April, stated that, and I'm going to read the whole quote here, the case against science is straightforward. And The Lancet, of course, is one of the most respected medical publications on the planet, as I understand it. There being, I guess at this time, literally tens of thousands of journals out there. But in any case, here's a quote from Richard Horton, editor-in-chief of The Lancet. The case against science is straightforward. Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue. Afflicted by studies with small sample sizes, tiny effects, invalid exploratory analyses, and flagrant conflicts of interest, together with an obsession for pursuing fashionable trends of dubious importance. And then the last phrase here just summarizes it all in a rather focused and disturbing way. The last phrase is, science has taken a turn towards darkness. That's a pretty strong phrase coming from somebody in his position and stature. We've got to run the break here. Let's go ahead and do that. We'll come right back, and Neil would love for you to jump in right after the break with any response or comment you want to have about that. But let's go ahead and get the break done here so then we're free for the rest of the show. You're listening to the Vaccine Agenda Internet Radio Show. I'm your host, Alan Phillips, vaccine rights attorney, and with me this evening, Neil Miller, in my opinion, one of the most well-researched and knowledgeable people about the vaccine issue comprehensively, but particularly on the science end of it, and we've been talking about his new book that's going to be coming out soon, Miller's Review of Critical Vaccine Studies, and it sounds like it's going to be just an invaluable resource for parents, legislators, doctors, lay people. It just sounds terrific. So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Stay right with us, folks. We are back live with the Vaccine Agenda Internet Radio Show. Neil Miller with us this evening. Neil, did you have any follow-up thoughts or comments there? I was talking about the editor of The Lancet.
Yeah, absolutely. I was aware of his article on that. And he's absolutely telling it straight like it is. He knows what's going on. I think with these large medical journals, what we're finding is I think we need to move to a new paradigm. And instead of publishing the studies from the biomedical industry, because what these studies generally are today, they're really just part of the marketing arm of the pharmaceutical industry, for example. That's what these studies are. You can't trust these studies anymore as being valid representatives of reality, so to speak, of factual truth. They don't really represent that, or at least many of them don't. Some of them do, but, you know, it's hard to wade through it. I think what the new paradigm maybe we need to move toward is where the editors and peer reviewers are going to really, I think they need to really get to the core and isolate the problems with the studies more deeply than what's going on today. Like I was saying, with the conflicts of interest and the various types of way that the industry controls things, I have studies here. Here's a study that was recently published where they confirmed that many scientists intentionally fabricate data and falsify scientific research. Here's another study by Martinson and Anderson where top scientists in the United States regularly engage in scientific misconduct that threatens the integrity of science. Here's another study, Terskers and Hamrick. Scientists at top research institutions in the United States receive benefits from industry that compromise the integrity of their studies. Here's another study by Fava. The pharmaceutical industry has control of scientific journals, censors intellectual freedom, and threatens the integrity of biomedical research. Here's another study by Smith. Medical journals benefit financially when they publish pharmaceutical industry studies that favor their products. See, this is another problem. The medical journals are actually in bed with the pharmaceutical companies. They benefit when they publish these bogus studies.
Do you see anything in these studies that offers an explanation? I mean, is it mostly good people succumbing to hard pressure, or do you have a sense of, you know, how does this happen? Because from an outsider's point of view, who, at least initially, we naively assume that the people who are doing this kind of work are people, they're very intelligent, they got in and out of medical school or accomplished researchers, and those are just always people of integrity because they're really smart people. Now, obviously, that turns out not to be the case a good deal of the time.
No, in fact, they have extreme pressure to produce studies, even if they're falsified. For example, this one study that I'm looking at here, and the title of the article is Scientists Behaving Badly. This was published in Nature, which is a prestigious journal. So researchers surveyed over 3,000 early and mid-career U.S. scientists funded by the National Institutes of Health, and they asked them to anonymously report their own scientific misbehavior during the previous 3 years. Overall, 33% of scientists funded by the National Institute of Health admitted that they engaged in questionable scientific behavior during the previous 3 years. Nearly 16% of NIH-funded scientists changed the design, methodology, or results of a study due to pressure from a funding source. 15% dropped data points from analyses. 14% used inadequate or inappropriate research designs. Okay, this is just one study. And like I said, I've got 17 of these. Why is it happening? The entire industry has been corrupted. It just needs a complete overhaul at this point. There's just too much power and greed and corruption, you know, in the pharmaceutical biomedical industry.
You know,
and the journals, they know, for example, that when they publish a study, even if they question whether the study is valid, they publish a big study from a pharmaceutical company, they know that as part of the deal, the pharmaceutical company will buy thousands and thousands of the reprints. That alone can bring $500,000 to $1 million just for one study. When they buy up these reprints, it can bring in $500,000 to the journal, okay? So that's just one way that the journal benefits. It biases the editors of these journals, who have to determine, they have limited space, they have to determine what's going to go into their journal. Now, if you're running this and you're on a tight budget and you have limited funds and things like that, and you have to pay all your people that work for you, all your employees, and you have to decide, here's a nice study written by independent researchers, can get published, take up a lot of space, cost money to publish, but they're not going to get anything in return, or publish this large study from a pharmaceutical company that they know has probably got a lot of problems, but, you know, they know that they're going to make $500,000 on it by just inserting it into their journal. And that's, like I said, is just one way that the system is gained, one way that the system is corrupted.
Well, I wouldn't want to let the researchers off the hook by saying it's not their fault. At the end of the day, if they're engaging in some inappropriate behavior, they have some responsibility. But I think I would like to see that article, instead of being titled, you know, whatever it was about, you know, doctors behaving badly, that we should put the focus, I think, in a different place, because it seems to me that those who are pressuring them to behave badly and doing so from a position of some strong influence. You know, if you genuinely believe that you've got to cross an ethical line somewhere in order to keep your job, you're going to be hard-pressed to hold to an ethical boundary if you know you're just going to get that at the next job, if you can even get the next job after you're fired
right.
from
right.
this one. So, again, it doesn't let them off the hook, but it really seems to me that the greater responsibility is up the ladder a peg or two there. But, boy,
part of the problem is with the CDC as well, the oversight that the CDC is supposed to be doing. The CDC has a dual mission, which conflicts with vaccine safety. It was given a dual mission in 1986 when Congress established an overarching vaccine law that said the CDC is responsible for promoting vaccines and also responsible for determining their safety. We need to take that safety function out of the hands of the CDC. It has to go into the hands of an independent oversight committee of some sort. I don't know how we pick that independent committee, but that needs to be done. I've got studies here that show that the CDC is reluctant to sponsor research that reveals safety problems. So the CDC itself self-censors any studies where it finds problems. I worked with Dr. Gary Goldman. He and I published two studies together. And Dr. Goldman worked for the CDC for 7 years. He's an expert on the varicella vaccine, chickenpox. And it also reactivates the shingles. And he was participating in a large-scale study monitoring what happens when they start vaccinating kids with the new chickenpox vaccine. All sorts of factors were being weighed. How does it affect the health of the kids? How does it affect reactivation of shingles and things like that? Well, the CDC was very happy to publish all the results that were showing that the chickenpox vaccine seemed to be effective, okay, when the kids were being vaccinated. And as those rates started to creep up, the vaccination coverage rates, so that you had 10% of the population vaccinated, from none of them being vaccinated, to 20%, to 30, to 40, to 50, well, as more and more of the population started to become vaccinated, there was less circulation of the chickenpox virus in society. So the vaccine seemed to be effective in that regard. But what Dr. Goldman discovered was that it actually increased rates of shingles, because people that get shingles, they're getting it because they need to be exposed to chickenpox to continually stimulate their immune system, to re-stimulate it. These are called exogenous boosts. So, for example, the elderly get chickenpox not just because their immunity is waning, but because they're not being exposed on a regular basis to the circulating chickenpox virus. So the chickenpox vaccine reduced the number of cases of chickenpox, but simultaneously increased the cases of shingles. Shingles is a much more serious and painful and expensive disease condition. And Dr. Goldman wanted to publish these studies. They were happy to publish studies that showed that the chickenpox vaccine was effective at lowering the circulation of chickenpox, but they didn't want anything to do with publishing the other side, the flip side, where it showed that for 50 years now, we're going to have increases of shingles in the population. They promoted that vaccine, the chickenpox vaccine, on the fact that it was going to be cost-effective. But they never factored in that it's going to take two doses. They originally calculated they're going to cost $30 a dose, but now they're $100 a dose. They never factored in that there's going to be exponential increases in shingles cases that are very expensive to care for in the hospital. They never factored that in. So all the data, all the studies, which I documented in my new book, some of which actually were published by Dr. Goldman, but also published by other researchers, show that the vaccine not only increased rates of shingles, but is no longer cost effective. So what was the answer for this? The answer was to develop a shingles vaccine. So they developed a chickenpox vaccine that caused increase in cases of shingles, and then they developed a shingles vaccine. But the CDC tried to suppress Dr. Goldman from publishing his information on the shingles, and he had to pursue legal remedies so that he could cause them to back off so that he could publish these. So the whole point of why I'm bringing this up is that the CDC is corrupt in its own way. The CDC is not interested in publishing anything that shows that vaccines have a problem. I have another study here, and it's called Methodological Issues and Evidence of Malfeasance in Research Purporting to Show Thimerosal in Vaccines is Safe. I summarize it and call it six CDC studies showing that mercury in vaccines is safe are unreliable and provide evidence of scientific malfeasance. In a nutshell, what's going on with this study, and this was by Dr. Hooker and Kern, and what's going on with this study is this, a lot of people don't realize that the CDC relies on six studies to tell everybody, to promote this idea, to present their propaganda that there's no link between vaccines and autism, or that there's no link between mercury or thimerosal in vaccines and autism. So the CDC sponsored all six of these studies. All six of these studies have methodological problems. These are bogus studies in various ways. And this study actually goes through all six of these studies that the CDC uses as their evidence that there's no link between mercury in vaccines and autism. This study goes through all six of these studies and shows individually, study by study, what's wrong with that study, why that study has problems, why that study can't be trusted, why that study is giving bogus and false evidence, false results. So this is a common problem, and people need to know that. They need to be aware that the CDC is in bed with the pharmaceutical industry. They are not looking after the best interests of our children. They're not looking after the best interests of society as a whole. And that's why people like you, people like me, people like Dr. Wakefield, all the people that are speaking out, all the people that are trying to wake parents up are doing it so that we can take some kind of control back, pass on this understanding to parents, to try to protect their children, to try to protect adults who keep getting these vaccines. I keep getting emails every single day from parents that take these vaccines and they have problems. I got an email today from a woman. She said she and her husband were opposed to vaccines, but her husband was forced to take a Prevnar vaccine. He developed Guillain-Barré syndrome within a week of taking that vaccine. Everybody denies it. The doctor refused to report it to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, even though he's legally obligated to do it. Doctors get around this by claiming they don't believe it's related to the vaccine.
The law doesn't give them that out, but the problem is there's no penalty in the law for not doing it, so it's a toothless law, so to speak.
Exactly. You know that better than anyone, being a lawyer that deals with vaccine issues. So anyway, I'm just voicing some of my concerns. I hope I'm not just on a soapbox preaching to the choir, hoping to get people that are on the fence with this issue coming over here to listen to your radio program and maybe being directed to it in the archives, maybe they can gain a little something from all these interviews. Every time we speak out, hopefully we can reach somebody a little bit more. I don't tell people that they should or should not vaccinate. I'm here for two things. I'm here because I represent informed choice and the freedom to accept or reject vaccines. People need to have access to all of the available information, not just the information that the medical industry and that the CDC and the FDA and that the pharmaceutical companies want you to have, okay? Parents are entitled to all of the available information. That's the true meaning of informed consent. They can't consent to anything in any informed capacity if they don't have access to all of the information. Studies like what I'm presenting here that show the other side where there's studies that are critical of vaccines. So parents need to have access to all the available information, and they must remain free to accept or reject vaccines.
And we must insist on that. And if we lose one battle in one state, in one legislature, don't say, oh, well, we tried. No, we've got to get that right back, and we've got to push this agenda in the other direction. Neil, it's been probably 4 or 5 years ago now. I sat down to make a list of what I knew off the top of my head were the legislative agenda items from our side in terms of furthering informed choice. And over the course of a couple of days, I shocked myself. I thought there would be like 3 or 4 or 5, maybe 6 or whatever, and I ended up with over a dozen, and that certainly is not all that's there. But there are a lot of problems with laws at the state law level, and this next point is not being critical of anyone, because we don't have the billion-dollar budget behind us to do whatever we want to do with our legislative agenda, but what I feel that we should have been doing 3, 4, 5 years ago is what the pharmaceutical industry has been doing in very recent months, and that is they're pushing multiple bills in multiple states, and that's really hard for us as a community, the alternative health community, to oppose in a coherent, focused, and effective way, although we certainly have had some successes around the country. But we've got to not only just be reactive and respond to bad bills when they're introduced, we've got to be introducing our own bills to move this agenda in the other direction. And I tell you, it sounds like this new book of yours is going to be a powerful tool for anyone to not only educate themselves, and, you know, because you never know it all, there's always more to learn on all different fronts, political, medical, legal, but something that somebody could hand to somebody else and say, hey, just skim through this, pick the, you know, look at this chapter if there was some particular point that came up in a conversation, for example.
Oh, I think yes, that absolutely. People can I hope to have this in the hands of all the legislators before they start passing new bills mandating vaccines.
Yeah, well, it sounds like just a potentially very powerful education tool, so thanks for all you've done over the years and decades, but this sounds like you've just taken everything you've done up to the next level with it. We have just about 1 minute here. Neil, tell people again where they can find you on the Internet or where they can find your book when it's out and your other books that are excellent books to go ahead and get now, and anything else you want folks to know about the work that you do.
Well, they can check out my website at thinktwice.com. There's another website, www.vacbook, it's V-A-C-B-O-O-K.com, and that lists the current books. I've written several books. 3 of them are still in print. 1 is a book that's being used as a reference right now by a lot of people. It's almost 400 pages. It's called The Vaccine Safety Manual. I also co-authored a book with Dr. Mayer Eisenstein, or the late Dr. Mayer Eisenstein. He was a good friend of mine, and we worked together on a book, and that's called Make an Informed Vaccine Decision. So that, with vaccines, are they really safe and effective? Like you said, that was the one that woke you up, and that one is still in print. We update it every year, reprint it. So those are the books currently in print. But this book that I'm working on right now is going to be the go-to book. It's just like I said, 1 study per page. At the top of the page is a bold headline that summarizes it. Then there's a quote taken directly from the study. There's the citation, and then there's several bullet points. So that it's really going to be an excellent reference for everybody directly from the peer-reviewed studies.
Well, that sounds really terrific. ThinkTwice.com, folks. ThinkTwice.com. Neil, thanks so much for being here. It's great to have you on. You're a wealth of information. Looking forward to seeing you again in Dallas, and best to you between now and then, and looking forward to seeing this book. Do let me know as soon as that is.
Yeah, you'll be one of the first to know, Alan.
Great, great, and I'll do pass it on to listeners and others as well. Well, we got to wrap it up, folks. We've hit the end of the show here. You've been listening to the Vaccine Agenda Internet Radio Show with host, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, and tonight, special guest, vaccine author and research